Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from San Francisco's historic Fairmont Hotel. I am Blas Perez Enriquez, your quarterly chairman. We also welcome the listeners of KPBS-FM in San Diego, California, one of the more than 200 radio stations nationwide carrying America's longest running radio program. We invite all our listeners here and on radio to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now, please allow me to introduce you to today's guest speaker. Louis Gerstner, Jr. is the present chairman and chief executive officer of International Business Machine Corporation. Mr. Gerstner has been described as an early net believer who mobilized the computer giant to make internet technology one of its top priorities. This visionary move has positioned IBM extremely well in the context of the new digital economy. It has also been said that Mr. Gerstner's ultimate goal is to have IBM stand for Internet Business Machines. Prior to joining IBM, Mr. Gerstner served for 4 years as chairman and chief executive officer of RJR Nabisco. This was preceded by an 11-year career at American Express Company, where he was president of the parent company and chairman and CEO of its largest subsidiary, American Express Travel-Related Services. Prior to that, Mr. Gerstner was a director of the management consulting firm of McKinsey & Company, which he joined in 1965. A native of Mineola, New York, Mr. Gerstner received a bachelor's degree in engineering from Dartmouth College in 1963 and an MBA from Harvard Business School in 1965. He has also been awarded several honorary degrees in business and engineering. In 1999, Mr. Gerstner was elected a member of the National Academy of Engineering, and in April 2000, a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. A lifetime advocate of the importance of quality education, Mr. Gerstner is co-author of Reinventing Education, Entrepreneurship in America's Public Schools. He co-chairs ACHIEVE, an organization created by U.S. governors and business leaders to drive high academic standards for public schools in the United States. At IBM, he has established Reinventing Education as a company's program in support of systemic school reform. At IBM, he has initiated strategic partnership with 21 states and school districts, which are utilizing IBM technology and technical assistance to eliminate key barriers to school reform and improve student performance. He has received numerous awards for his work in education, among them the Cleveland E. Dodge Medal for Distinguished Service to Education, Teachers College, Columbia University, and the Distinguished Service to Science and Education Award from the American Museum of Natural History. Mr. Gerstner is also the first recipient of Washington University's Combined Excellence in Business, Engineering, and Technology Award, and the first to receive the Visionary Award for New Visions for Public Schools. And now, please join me in welcoming our distinguished guest speaker, Louis Gerstner, Jr., Chairman and CEO of IBM, to this podium.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. As I prepared to speak with you today, I reflected on the very distinguished roster of speakers who have stood before the Commonwealth Club over the past 97 years. I weighed all the vital issues and pressing challenges that we see facing business, government, society today, and then I said, gee, what could I possibly say that would be of value to you? And I found myself thinking about unicorns. Now, you know the unicorn, the mythical beast that appears every so often. It ambers onto the scene, and it just sort of wanders off, and usually it's gone for a long time. A most peculiar animal. And I thought, it's just reappeared. The unicorn is back with us today. It's called the Education President. You also know this animal. It shows up every 4 years. It proclaims that it's high time to fix public education in this country, to elevate the issue, to kick up a little dust, and then poof, It disappears, usually around mid-January. And when it goes, we don't despair, because we know there'll be another sighting in exactly 4 years. This pattern has been repeating itself for at least 20 years when we first recognized that there was a crisis in U.S. public education. Two decades later, our schools are only marginally better than they were when we started. And they're better by an even slimmer margin than they were 10 years later when a stunningly bleak report on our schools called A Nation at Risk was published. Marginally better, despite the heroic efforts of dedicated administrators, committed principals, and legions of great teachers. I spent this morning with some of them and a lot of great kids at Fairmont Elementary School. Now, you might ask, if the crisis in our public schools is that intractable, and if progress is achieved so grudgingly, why in the world would any right-thinking presidential candidate want to make this his or her issue? Well, it's because every major and minor poll in the United States says that more than crime, more than drugs, more than poverty, more than health care, foreign affairs, or national security, the American people say that fixing public education is this nation's number one issue. And it is. Our generation has witnessed the wasting decline of the one institution that has to be good enough and strong enough to carry our country forward into this new century. And the stakes we're playing for just went up. Because there is simply no doubt that the world of e-business is going to drive global competition on a scale we have never seen before. I believe that the network world, and in this network world that's emerging, the single greatest factor separating winners and losers in all industries and, in fact, in all societies will be the ability to use information and to build a culture based on knowledge and the ability to learn. So whether we're ready or not, all businesses will compete on a global stage. So must our workforce, so must our schools. Yet every day our public schools are open, the gulf between our kids and the rest of the world grows wider. We're content with incremental gains while the competition is racing to prepare their kids for the workplace of the 21st century. I don't want to load you up with survey data and statistics, but let me just share a few points from the third international math and science study that was released this year. At the fourth grade, in math and science, our kids are right up there with the best in the world. By the eighth grade, we rank 28th overall. By the 12th grade, we trail every developed nation in the world. And even our very best math students can't compete with their counterparts around the world. Our top kids are last among 16 countries to test physics and math. The problem isn't dumb kids. Remember, our kids start at no deficit. They're at the top in the fourth grade. The deficit they end up with is inflicted upon them by a system that expects too little and then routinely rewards substandard performance against even those minimal requirements. Far too often, it appears that we're not even trying. Only about a half of our high school students take a chemistry course. Only a quarter enroll in physics. Why so little progress? Why aren't we competing? How could this possibly be the record of achievement of a succession of education presidents? The fact is that no president, and this will apply to the president-elect as well, has much direct control over the outcome of this struggle. This is not a problem that yields to solutions at the federal level for several reasons. One, in the parlance of the U.S. Constitution, education in this country is a power reserved. The lion's share of the rules and operating principles are set at the state and local level. Two, follow the money. We spend nearly $400 billion a year on public education, but only 6 cents of every education dollar comes from the federal government. The other 94 cents comes out of local pockets raised and allocated by states and municipalities. Three, political self-interest. Although you'd hope we could muster a nonpartisan approach to an issue that affects rural people and city folk and cuts across every economic threshold, every ethnic community, every political affiliation, the fact is the issue is highly politicized at all levels of our government. Okay, then, if it's not the job of the federal government to fix this problem, then whose job is it? Well, if we've learned anything in the last 20 years, I hope it's that these problems cannot be solved by the schools themselves. So no finger pointing. This is an intensely American problem, and it affects all of us. So the fight to reform our system of public education, by definition, has to involve the entire community, and that includes the business community. And despite the fact that American business has more to gain if we succeed and more to lose if we fail than any constituency except the kids themselves, we, the American business community, remain strangely absent on this issue. One reason, like a lot of other constituencies in our society, is that American business is always looking for the expedient solution. Write a check, adopt a school, send computers. I'm sorry to be the one to say it, but there are no silver bullets in public education reform. The changes that must be made can't be expressed in a soundbite. And no, they will not be revealed to us in a decree from Washington. That said, the issue of public education's bearing on a healthy society and a competitive economy has been my personal passion for 30 years. And today I'm pleased to report that more than at any other time, I see reason for hope. Not just because we can point to a few pockets of progress, like I saw at that elementary school this morning, or not because the issue of public education is once again the top of the national agenda, whatever that means. National consensus about the fact that we have a problem is nothing new, nor is high-minded agreement that something has to change. What is new and what's fueling my optimism is what's happening as a result of a group of very powerful Americans coming together twice in the last 4 years at two national education summits. The critical attendees were state governors, including Governor Davis, because, as I've said, they control most of the spending. The governors were joined by business leaders and last year by educators, the teachers' unions, and parents. These governors didn't gather to ponder or to pontificate or to pose for photo ops. I was there. They checked their partisan agendas at the door, and they went right to the heart of what we're going to have to do and how we're going to do it. The summits produced unprecedented consensus, agreement, unanimous agreement, that reform starts with world-class standards, supported by a system of measurement and the discipline to hold people accountable for results. Agreement about this urgent need for a vastly improved teaching profession. An agreement that we have to have and get very serious about building a demanding, high-quality curriculum. Now, unless I miss my guess, some of you are sitting there thinking, that's it? You call these great skull sessions together, and that's the outcome? High standards, better teacher training, tougher courses, and accountability for results? Yes, that's it. So fundamental and so straightforward. And guess what? It is utterly unattainable unless we break with the status quo in American education, unless we dismantle and discard the dysfunctional elements and do it with a sense of urgency. In short, we are now at the hard part: tactics, execution, and implementation. Setting standards is hard work. Reaching them is much, much harder. Do you realize that until recently, we were the only developed country in the world that had never written down what our kids needed to learn, what they needed to be able to do to be successful wage earners, enlightened citizens, and informed parents? Heading into the first summit in 1996, only 14 states in our country had any standards at all for public education. The educational community and the politicians were polarized over the issue of standards. Today, the debate is behind us. Every state but one has standards in place. Many of them are excellent. Some, however, still set the bar pretty low. This year, all but two states will conduct assessments of how they're doing at the elementary, middle, and high school level in both reading and math. That's good, but less than a third have a state assessment in science. Only a relatively handful of our schools issue school-wide report cards or school ratings. Fewer still impose graduation and promotion exams. And we conduct virtually no meaningful cross-state and cross-border comparisons. But again, we can point to some very important reasons for hope. Let me show you one. This I'm holding up is a sample math test. A math test. It's the first of its kind. 10 forward-thinking states in the United States have come together under the leadership of ACHIEVE to develop and administer it to all eighth graders with the help of the College Board. That's good. But what's even better is the commitment to compare results across the states, school by school, state by state. Very soon, we're going to know something we don't know today: who's excelling and who needs help. Okay, 10 states are in, 40 aren't. But we're moving. There's some momentum. It's in pockets, but it's there. Now, if we're going to take the next step and drive for radically improved student performance, we know a lot of things have to change. To get from no standards to high standards, we're going to have to subject many of the basic conventions of what happens in our schools to bone-jarring changes. The two priorities, as I just indicated, are teaching and curriculum. For openers, we cannot expect our kids to compete if our teachers can't. Right now, less than a third of American teachers have done any in-depth study in the subject they teach. 4 out of 10 high schoolers taking chemistry, physics, or earth science will be taught by an instructor that hasn't even minored in science. Like all the big issues, this one has multiple dimensions. We should reward those. We need to start with our schools of education, our teachers' colleges. We should reward those that strengthen academic content and that produce teachers who succeed in the classrooms. But those that consistently turn out teachers that fail to perform should find their funding and their ability to grant degrees at risk. Once they're in the classroom, all teachers need continuous, high-quality professional development. Every year, the average elementary school teacher in Japan gets 90 hours of education outside the classroom. In the U.S., it's 8 hours. A single day in a 180-day school year dedicated to self-renewal. And how much are our schools investing in professional development for our teachers? 3 to 5% of the money spent in the districts, a lot of which is wasted on what the teachers call drive-by training. As a starting point, let's triple the ante. Let's spend 10% of the school budget at a minimum to invest in our teachers and their training. I think 15% sounds more reasonable. And not a penny of it should go to teachers who amass college courses that have no bearing on student learning or what they do in the classroom. There's one more critical investment we have to make here. We have a critical shortage of teachers, and the forecasts only say that it's going to get worse. We can wring our hands, we can fret, we can say how awful this is. Or we can get serious about solving the problem and start by paying our teachers a competitive wage. Time and grade isn't meaningless in schools, but it's far from the most important factor in any teacher's effectiveness. How about pay based on what's happening in the classroom? Results, achievement, progress. Performance-based pay is a necessary step. It can be done fairly. I applaud districts like Cincinnati that have made a start and states like California that are boosting salaries by up to $10,000 for teachers with national board certification. Because high student achievement is possible, but it will only follow high teacher achievement. Next, let's face up to the fact that even the very best teachers in the world cannot move our kids to where they need to be unless they're going into the classroom armed with a challenging world-class curriculum. Our problem here is that, for the most part, American education is a mile wide and an inch deep. In math, for example, we are trying to cover far too many topics in the early grades, and as a result, our children fail to master the basics. Then in the later grades, while we're going back over multiplication tables, countries like Japan have algebra in 70% of eighth grade math courses. Here, it's under 10%. Geometry isn't even present in most of our eighth grade curriculums. So we have to focus. We have to go deep, and fundamentally, we have to have the courage to ask more of our kids. That means, though, that we have to do more than just set the bar higher. We have to be prepared to provide the kids that need it with extra help after school and summer school. And finally, we've got to trust the people in the schools to run them, not the central district staff, the people that live with the kids. The principals and teachers must have greater autonomy in decisions about how they allocate their time, over personnel decisions, how money is spent, and over adaptation to meet the needs of the kids in their schools. Now, since we are in California, and because you're less than a month away from your vote on Proposition 38, you may have noticed that I left vouchers out of my recipe for change. Let me offer a perspective, not on your specific proposal. I do not wish to comment on the specific proposition, but within the general context of my message today. On one level, the voucher movement expresses a very important idea. Vouchers are about choice. Choice in the hands of parents and kids. And choice, in my opinion, is a critical part of what I'm talking about today, standards, measurement, and accountability. I'm in favor of competition and choice, and I would never deny a child the chance to escape from a failing school. But there's a big difference between deciding which kids get a seat in the lifeboat and saving the ship. Nobody would question the desirability of saving the few who make it into the lifeboat. The problem is that we have 48 million children enrolled in public schools in America. And it's either very naive or enormously risky to think that we can abandon the public school system and replace it with some other alternative. First, there is simply no physical capacity to do that today, and there may never be. If only 10% of the kids in our public schools exercise vouchers for private schools, we'd have to build 5,000 new schools from scratch, or double the number of schools in the 10 largest school systems in America combined. The cost, roughly $40 billion. Where'd the money come from? Where's it going to come from? Pretty unclear. But second, and more important to me, is that the fundamental premise, I believe, of our democratic system of government is based on citizens educated in a vibrant, healthy system of public education. If our schools don't work, our country won't work. So the objective here must be to fix the system. It's not to build a few special schools or help a few or even a few thousand selected children. To help all the children. And that must be our objective. We have to begin with a commitment to fix our problem, not to wire around it. The voucher message should be an important wake-up call to the American education system. What it says is that the American people are impatient. These are very well-intentioned people, lots of them who care passionately about getting a better education for our children. They're willing to fight for it, and that's great. We need to do just that. But within the system, not outside it. The fact is, if people don't start seeing change in American public schools, improvements, progress, results, and fast, then America is going to create their own mechanisms to force the change. Let me conclude with this. We've still got the issue of that unicorn and its appropriate role in American education. Right now, we've got one party telling us we're in the middle of an education revival and another saying we're in the middle of an educational recession. Either way, a lot of the discussion in the current presidential race gets mired fairly quickly in some of the peripheral issues. More money, vouchers, class size. Again, these are not trivial issues. Sure, kids ought to have a desk and be able to sit down during class. I mean, who could disagree? But once we're all comfortably seated, what happens? Is the teacher inspirational? Is the curriculum valid? Are we learning anything? We can't start with the symptoms. We've got to attack the underlying problems. So what we need from our president, first and foremost, is a broad, consistent, articulate message that says, we are going to fix the problem that is public education in America. And we're going to start with standards, with the leadership of great teachers, working with world-class curricula, supported by rigorous measurement and of our progress, and accountability for all. We're already established. I've already established today on that subject, most of the action is going to be local. So there isn't a lengthy agenda of things that any president can do. But there are some things that only a president can do. So I have a few questions for both candidates. I'm wondering if, when elected, our president would be willing to issue a periodic report card on the state of our schools, on what we've accomplished, and where we stand versus other nations. Better still, if we're going to have the education president our country desperately needs, will you, Mr. President, go beyond a report card and stand before the American people once a year on television, on the internet, and deliver an annual state of the classroom address? Will you work with the governors to tell the American people whether the states really are implementing standards that are world class and honestly represent what our children need to know in order to be successful? Will you update us, Mr. President, on the status of the teaching profession in America? What's happened in the last year to establish performance standards, to dramatically upgrade the way we train our teachers, support them, and pay them? Mr. President, what can you tell us about improvements in our core curriculum, year by year, state by state? How many of our kids take geometry, trig, calculus, chemistry, or physics? How many can read and express complex ideas? How many understand civics and their responsibilities in a democratic society? Finally, Mr. President, will you use the awesome platform of your office to minimize the noise and distractions and keep the debate focused on the right issues? Will you create an environment in which the urgent need for reform is constantly reinforced and increasingly understood by the American people? An environment where the governors and educators who are pushing hardest for reform will be supported rather than abandoned as soon as things get hot? Will you help parents understand that when we ask our kids to step up to more challenging courses and to pass tough tests that demonstrate what they've learned, we're doing it because we care about them? That we care about whether they're going to be able to earn a decent wage and secure a decent future, or whether they're being passively sentenced to life in an ever-shrinking pool of economic opportunity? Do that, Mr. President, and you'll do some good. You'll do more than that. You'll make a real difference on the highest of national priorities. So why not, Mr. President? Why not? At a minimum, it would bring the unicorn back every year. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Louis Gerstner, Chairman and CEO of IBM, for your remarks on this very important topic for the future of America. Now, Skip Rhodes, President of the Commonwealth Club, will conduct our question and answer session.
Thank you, Blas Perez Jarenquez, our quarterly chairman. Mr. Gerstner, we have a load of questions, so if you could return to the podium, we'll try our best. And I might say that as I was shuffling the questions, Mr. Gerstner answered many of them, and we still have many, many left. Let's start with this one. Member of the audience asks, tell us about this forum called ACHIEVE that met twice and came up with the four recommendations.
Well, what happened is the governors came together twice with business leaders. And by the way, the governors insisted that the business leaders be there because the governors say they can't get the changes pushed through the legislature and through the public opinion without help from business leaders. So I hope the business leaders in this group understand their importance in helping the governors affect local change. We came together, and as a result of that, we created ACHIEVE. The summits led to the creation of ACHIEVE. ACHIEVE is an organization that has six governors and six American CEOs on its board of directors. And it is a private organization funded by foundations and American business organizations to raise standards and measurement and accountability in U.S. public education, a professional organization designed to do just that, to share experiences. It has a wonderful website where you now can find all these standards from all these different states around the country. It does benchmarking of standards. It is the organization that worked with the states to produce the math test. And so we're a small little group, but we count on the clout of the governors and the support of the business community to affect a very powerful change agenda in this country. Governor Davis is a member of the ACHIEVE board.
What are the educational models in the United States that work best, and are there consistent elements?
First of all, we can find great schools everywhere in America. What the problem is we don't have a system for institutional leadership and change. A great school in America today takes a heroic principal. A heroic principle, fighting off a system that doesn't allow the kind of change that we need to get done. So we do still have some great schools. I mean, I don't know how many of you do this, but please do it soon. I was in a public school today. I mean, there's nothing that will get you more excited than going in a public school and seeing seventh graders asking you questions. Sorry, not seventh graders, 7 and 8 year olds, fourth graders asking you questions and understanding the conditions under which they go to school and the dedication of the teachers. So we have wonderful people in the system that want to see improvement. But we've got to help them with systemic change across the whole system. That means high standards, measurement and accountability, or how are we doing? We don't want to measure how people do because we want to punish somebody. We want to measure how we're doing so we can help somebody. I mean, it is absolutely unacceptably, I believe, from a moral point of view, to let a child go through 8 years of school without understanding how is that child doing and what can we do to intervene early to help that child. And that requires some form of measurement, some form of testing. And the people who fight testing don't understand that they are trying to blame the thermometer for the fever. And we have got to have a way of understanding how our kids are doing. So I would say the best schools are those that have adhered to high standards. That, of course, has to be set at the state level because schools can't set their own standards. That have teachers who feel rewarded for what they do, freedom to do things on the local school level basis, and have parents involved, and the teachers are really trained for what they do. But it's got to be done state by state.
This member of the audience asks, in my short career in the business world, I've been particularly amazed by the poor writing skills of even my more educated employees. Are writing skills a part of the standard you described?
Absolutely. One of the things that we have learned about the current state of our schools is that it's not just the hard subjects of math and science and language that people are really falling behind, but it is in students' ability to communicate in writing and verbally. I saw one analysis recently that said only 17% of American high school students can read a paragraph on a complex subject and then write a cogent summary of what it said. 17%. So in a society where knowledge is not only important, but collaboration and sharing of knowledge in a network world, the ability to communicate is absolutely essential. And our kids, for the most part, have fallen behind dramatically in their ability to in both verbal and written communication.
Education begins at home, but many kids are handicapped by poor or absent parents. How can we psychologically prepare these kids for study and support them along the way?
Well, that's a very important question. One of the extraordinary pressures that we have put on our schools, our public schools in America in the last 20 years, is a social responsibility that goes way beyond what they were intended to do, what they're funded to do, what they're trained to do. I mean, I remember being in a school in Washington, D.C., probably 10 years ago, and the teacher told me that not only does she feed in the morning, not the lunch program, but she has to give food to these children who come to her classroom every morning, but more than half of the children, she washes their clothes before they start the class time. I mean, this is a burden that our society has placed on our schools that in many ways overwhelms them. So the first thing I would say to you is that if we're going to have a world-class education system, we also have to fix a lot of the issues of poverty in our society. I mean, we have to have children coming to school who have gone to sleep in a bed the night before and have eaten something before they come to class, and they know that somebody's expecting them to come home at the end of the day. Now, what the schools have done, the really great schools, is they work around the problem. They work around the problem. If they can't find a parent, they find somebody else who is kind of a caregiver. That was the term that was used in the school I was in this morning. There's a caregiver somewhere they'd like to find. It's a neighbor. It's somebody. It's a grandmother or somebody who can take an interest in that child. And so I think we should be proud of what our schools have done in trying to sort of deal with this terrible problem. But they're not made, they're not funded, they're not taught how to do this. We have got to fix the poverty problem before we can totally fix the school problem.
Mr. Gerstner, this questioner asks something that follows up in a larger context, the question we just asked you. Is part of the reason for the lower performance of students after the ninth grade actually the societal context surrounding them? Distracted and overworked families, media full of violence and lacking serious content, and not in the education system itself. How do we deal with these factors as they impact education?
These questions are getting tougher. How many more are there? I'm not a sociologist. I honestly don't want to try to be definitive in answering that question. You know, are there distractions, enormous distractions on our children today? Absolutely. Would you like to see a culture in America that valued education more than it does today? I mean, I really think that's think about the Olympics. Think about if our Olympic team was 28th in the world. What would our country be saying today? What kind of an uproar would it be if our Olympics were 28th in the world? Our children are 28th in the world in math and science. You got to ask yourself, what is the culture in America that might place a higher value on winning medals over helping children? Now, I don't want to overdo this, but I guess what I'm saying is, yeah, again, like poverty, we have to have, this is what I said, I think our educational president needs to keep this issue of reform before the American people all the time from a bully pulpit. But again, I don't think we can stop the reformation of our schools until we go fix how much children watch television or how many hours of sports they take every weekend. I don't want to suggest that that's an excuse. It's not an excuse. Those are real issues. But there are things we can do. We can keep working on the schools despite that environment. But changing the environment would be very helpful.
Some commentators, even within the technology industry, argue that computers for very young students interfere with the basics of learning and are better left until high school and college. Where do you come down on this issue?
Clearly not with that person. I don't mean the person that asked the question. I mean the person who made the statement that was alluded to in the question. Look, computers are tools. They're like any other technology. Used right, they're enormously helpful. Used poorly, they're either neutral or they're negative. I mean, that's true of every great technology we've created in the world, right? It's true of the automobile. It's true of manned flight. It's true of everything. It can either be used for good or it can be used for harm or for wasting your time. And how many of us have said to our children when they're talking on the telephone, stop wasting your time talking on that telephone, but think about what that telephone does when there is an emergency somewhere and some elderly person is at home and needs help. The same is true of computers. In the education community in the United States, or in the United States, the education community really was not responsible for this, there's been this race to put computers into schools. And the view is, if we just gave everybody a computer, the education crisis would be over. Well, the problem is if you just put computers in the school, first of all, the teachers don't know how to use them for the most part. And then what the kids learn when they first arrive at school is how to play games on them. And so they might hone their game skills in the computer lab. The computers have to be integrated into a world-class curriculum. And again, from personal example, I saw this morning computers being used for enormously important things in schools. Now, the objectives were early intervention to help children at risk. That's the objective. We've been doing that in schools for 20, 30 years. The computer just makes it better. I also saw a computer used to teach young people health about health issues. And we've always talked to our kids about better health in junior high school and high school. This teaches it to them on the computer in their context, in their way they think, in a visual experience that you could never get with a textbook. It's a tool. So I think we ought to only view it that way. Now, the other argument that's made that children can spend so much time on the internet as youngsters that they fail to develop a set of social skills is a real issue. It's no different than what we found with television, no different than we find, again, with any new preoccupation in our society. But it doesn't mean that the internet is bad or the computers are bad. It just means, guess what? We as parents and as a society, we have to present a life, a set of objectives, a set of thinking to children that gives them some balance. But that's our problem, not the computer.
Our higher education system, which includes many great public colleges and universities, is the envy of this world. Are there any lessons that the success of higher education can pass on to our public schools, starting with high schools?
That is one of the great conundrums of the American education system. We have the best collegiate-level schools in the world. I mean, no matter where you go in the world, whether it's Europe or Asia or Latin America, the well-educated, well-meaning, in most cases, wealthy families want to send their kids to our universities. They do not want to send their kids to our elementary schools because they know when they go back home, they're two or three grades behind where they were in many cases. Why is that? Well, again, I don't think there's an easy answer, but I would say to you that one of the answers is choice. Universities have to compete for students. They have to compete for students. In most places in America, children are doomed or blessed to go to a school that somebody assigns them to. And so the issue of accountability isn't there. Now, I saw an extraordinary sign driving through San Francisco this morning. I mean, I wish I'd had a camera. It was a school. I mean, I didn't even know it was a school, but there was a big banner, a huge banner, like you'd see at a sports stadium, hanging outside this building, and it said, "Come see our test scores. We are enrolling now." Now, that's what that banner said. And I said to my colleague in the car, I said, that must be one of the, the private schools that are appearing all over the country. And I have discovered since I've been here that is a public school. Now, that is a public school saying we're proud of what we do. We're going to compete for the attention of parents and students. And guess what? Guess what? There has to be a principal and a group of teachers from a school 5 miles away that drive by that building. There has to be a parent that calls up the principal or teacher and says, I'm moving my student because I went in and found out about what the school down the road is doing. Now, our collegiate system lives in that world. It has to compete. It has to compete for students. There are other differences, too. I mean, there's less statewide regulation, a lot of other reasons for it, but I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, if you're not guaranteed a constituency, it's no different in our churches, it's no different in our synagogues, it's no different in our political process. I mean, you know, having to prove yourself on a regular basis has something to do about your performance.
How can our major corporations make a significant impact on education and educating our youth?
Well, boy, that question I really like. We'd love some help at Achieve. I don't want to solicit here, but we could use a little help, those of us who are funding Achieve, but that's the least important. I think there's a whole lot of things you can do. I think you need to understand in whatever state you choose. Some of us operate in obviously lots of states, but many of us have home states. Get involved. Get involved. Find out from your governor what is the state of our schools? Where are we? What are we trying to do? What is being done for teachers? What is the curriculum that children in our state are studying? Is it a world-class curriculum? Do we have tests that measure, or more than test, assessment systems, how children are doing? I mean, the problem with education is it's local and diverse, and the American business community sort of likes to go to Washington or Sacramento or somewhere else, have a meeting. It's all bundled up into one senator or one congressman, one administrator. You make your pitch, and you go home. Messy education reform. And so you got to make a commitment to say, I'm really going to get involved and I'm going to participate. Now, I also think there are a lot of things that you can do in your community, I mean, inside your company. First, and the National Alliance of Business is pushing this very hard along with Achieve, ask for high school graduation performance every single time you consider hiring somebody. I mean, I didn't realize this had fallen away. I mean, when I grew up, we all worried a lot about our grades in high school because we thought the guy that we was going to hire us was going to look at them. It isn't done anymore in America in many places. All you have to do is say to your HR people, let's start saying that when we go to hire people, we want to see somebody's high school record. Be amazed how it begins to recreate the connection between doing well in life and doing well in school, and we've lost that connection, particularly in the urban centers. Next, encourage your employees to participate on PTA, on boards of school boards. At IBM, we give people time off to be on school boards, paid time off. We train them on how a school board works. I mean, it is really strange how a school board works. We have taken our matching gift program, where we match contributions that employees make, and we have created a special category for K through 12, where they can get incremental matching gifts from the company to go for equipment to go into schools. I mean, there's a lot of things you can do, and if you really are interested, you can call the IBM Public Affairs Department in Armonk, New York. Stan Litow, who runs our foundation, is right here, and we'll give you lots of ideas on what you can do.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time. That is our last question. We had some cream puff questions waiting in the wings, Mr. Gerstner, but we'll wait for another time. Our thanks to Louis B. Gerstner, Jr., Chairman and CEO of IBM, for his remarks here today. We also thank our audience here at the Fairmont Hotel, as well as those listening on nationwide radio, and invite all of you to visit us again here soon. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's oldest continuous public affairs forum, is adjourned.